detail on the 6 weeks in October, November, September, October.
Very late September,
October, early November 1977, and what you did.
Right. I went back. We had the meeting between Secretary Vance and Foreign Minister Quang Hua, the 29th of September, I think, or the 30th. When I went back to New York for a meeting with the Secretary on a Saturday, the 1st of October, and the purpose was to try and clarify, I think, about where we go from here, since the Secretary had told Foreign Minister that Woodcock will have the answer, which we are not yet ready to give. It was at the end of that meeting, when we agreed to go forward, that Bill Gleystein was given the charge to prepare the paper. And this is Saturday. I asked Bill how long it would take. Oh, he said, this is almost a weekend job. Call me on Monday. You may as well go back to Rochester, Michigan, where I had an apartment. So I went back, called him on Monday, and he said, it's taking longer than I thought. And call again on Wednesday, or maybe Thursday. And then when I called then, well, it is taking longer. Others are having trouble putting the words together, he said. And so I waited and then came in for a meeting on the 12th of October. These first meetings were with staff, and I have no clear memory of them. They must have been just general discussions, I think, with no real focal point. And Bill had not enlightened me as to what the problem was. In fact, I never was enlightened as to what the problem was. And then on the 14th of October, a further meeting with Secretary Vance, which again, as I stated, I think, before, we agreed again in principle. And it was then the drafting was turned over to someone other than Bill. And who that person was, unfortunately, I didn't make note, and I have no memory. Then I went back again to wait. Came in on the 21st I was asked to come in and out on the same day where we had a staff meeting on the paper, which was inconclusive. And then I recorded before the business with Phil Habib when he said, well, you may as well go back. No point to waiting. Go back without instructions. And that was brought to a head by my saying I wouldn't unless I first saw the president, if he would receive me. And, well, wouldn't you first see the secretary before you do that? And I said, of course. And we had another meeting with the secretary, which brought it to a conclusion. And I returned to Peking on the 4th of November. On amusing little interlude, stopped off in Tokyo, stayed with Mike Mansfield at the residence, and the night of the 3rd, we had a dinner. There were just three of us, Mike Mansfield, Hugh Scott, and myself, and I thought it was a very pleasant dinner. But when I returned to Washington the next time, I picked up some anecdote that Hugh Scott had told people that he had had dinner with Mansfield and Woodcock at the Tokyo Embassy, and he said it was a very difficult evening. I would make a 2 or 3 minute comment, and Mansfield would say, yep, and Woodcock would grunt. Well, neither Mike nor I normally are given to making long-winded speeches on social occasions. I don't think it was quite as bad as as Hugh Scott said. Also, when I got to Peking, Harry Thayer and his new wife were there for Harry's first visit back to China. since having been the deputy DCM, and he was there for several days, and of course he was very much brighter, more optimistic man as a result of his marriage. He had several excellent days meeting with staff and meeting with Chinese. And then they left after about 5 or 6 days to take the Chinese Trans-Siberian to Moscow.
Did he enlighten you as to the problems?
No, the most that was ever said to me, the staff difficulties. And, I never knew really what the hang-up was or where it was coming from or anything.
Okay. You know, I would want to check my memory, and check others' memory, but I think one possibility was whether your presentation was to initiate the normalization discussions or whether it was to be essentially a temporizing presentation.
We had to give an answer because an answer had been promised. We couldn't, after all, 3 months had already gone by, so there'd be some kind of answer to bridge until we were really ready to decide whether to bite the bullet. I think that's probably true.
Right, and then I think I was involved in it because what we were weighing, but I'm surprised you were not drawn into the discussions, I think what we were weighing was the risk of a temporizing response. How long could, given that the Vance trip was not as successful as we had hoped, how long could we go on temporizing? I think that's the question that one would have to begin probing and asking whether there were some policy papers that were circulating at state on timing of normalization.
Well, I think I probably was made aware that this paper was not conclusive and it was to fill in. Because it was clearly not conclusive, but what I really meant to say was I was not aware of any strong opposition and people deliberately holding things up because they were opposed to any final move being made. And it was during the Thayer's visit that I made my first trip to the Mao Memorial Hall to see the remains. The liaison office staff had a visit arranged while I was gone. And I must say that when you walk in and you see that white figure, which seems so much copied after the Lincoln statue and the Lincoln Memorial, quite an eerie feeling. And the whole business was made a little more unreal to me when I stepped out on the far side into the bright sunshine. A Chinese woman in Western clothes comes running up to me saying, "Mr. Woodcock, so good to see you. And I hope to see you again." And then goes back into the crowd. Best of my knowledge, I had never seen, well, I know, but subsequently I'd never seen her before, and I was completely mystified.
Who was it?
She was a Chinese-American from the Detroit area. She knew me very well from seeing my picture on television and so on, and who did come to see me, and was hoping she could get a job working in the liaison office, which of course didn't work out.
Did Mao's body deteriorate during your time in China over the coming 2 years?
I think I was there two more times, maybe three. And there was a decided deterioration in the later, what I saw in the later visits than what I saw first on the 6th of November, 1877.
This summer, his body was on the dark side, even beginning to be black.
It's been some time since I've seen him.
I don't think it will last forever.
Well, of course, the Chinese don't do much embalming. There's only three cities in which they do it: Peking, Shanghai, Canton. Became aware of that because we had a few instances where Americans died. They would pack them in dry ice until they got the instructions that if they were to be taken back to the U.S. for burial, then they'd keep them packed in dry ice and they'd be sent to one of those cities for embalming. If they were to be cremated, of course, then that was done on the spot. But so I doubt if they have much skill in that regard, and I think that's what's happened to the chairman's body, which does present a nice political problem.
Also, he was not embalmed immediately upon his death, so that there was probably some decay supposed to be done swiftly.
Yeah.
Well, we can talk more about that later. We now move to the period then of your return.
During this whole period, I was spending a great deal of time making courtesy calls on ambassadors and other ambassadors, because I tried to cover everybody rather than just pick, as I was advised to do, the more important. And although it took a lot of time, I think it was worthwhile to do it. Then it was in that same month of November, on the 25th, that we had the first reception for a big Chinese this was the first reception in which we had an American visiting delegation with their Chinese counterparts, who all came together to the residence. This happened to be the Petroleum Equipment Delegation, which was sponsored by the National Committee for U.S.-China Trade, and there were 60 of them. So that was we felt quite pleased with that, because it showed a widening of the exposure that we were having. And also during this period, we were asking to see ministries which up until that time, the life of the liaison office had been closed. The petroleum minister, for example, Kang Xuran at that time. And I visited with him, and also the sports minister, who received me in his army uniform. And several others, so that the staff felt quite pleased with this, because we were, in a small way, breaking some new ground.
Well, we noticed that, and I remember doing a memo Force Big on, I think I mentioned this to you last week, memo on something like 15 or 18 signals of the Chinese that they were eager to upgrade the nature of their relationship with us and to move forward.
And it was in this period that the delegation from the Committee for Present Danger visited China at their invitation, headed by Paul Nitzan. The other members were David Packard, Max Kampelman, Joe Harper, and an advertising man whose name I did not record and escapes me.
Eugene Rostow was on it too, wasn't he?
No, Eugene came on a separate visit during that same period.
I see.
He may have come after the Kennedy visit, which came at the end of December. But I was invited, of course, to the dinner which Hao Te-Ching, their host, gave to them. And as Hao Te-Ching is giving his toast, he takes note of the meetings they're going to have. But since they are all common citizens, like he is a common citizen, it probably would be better if the meetings were not did not include governmental officials, which if the ambassador will has no objection. Well, I was under the circumstances, since we had widely differing views, quite happy to to have that ground rule. And had a reception for them at the residence, which got to be a very vigorous debate, not over the question of the present danger in the Soviet Union, but whether or not we should normalize relations with China, with Paul Nitze in particular taking very vigorous exception. Yes, in time, 20 years, anyway, it would be a long time. But we had a very vigorous discussion. And I had the feeling when we finished that two were still for the not doing it for a long time. Two were for, came around to a point of view that, well, maybe it should be pressed fairly soon. And one was neutral. We talked, of course, a great deal about Taiwan and the good and faithful allies. I remember the advertising man said, look, I engage in a lot of polling work. The average American doesn't even know where Taiwan is. And rather than being very much worried about it, he says, stick to your guns.
One way of describing an absolutely crucial role that you played during this time was as an advocate of administration policy to the stream of Americans who started to come through the embassy. And I think you had a considerable impact on the thinking of people, as this group and numerous businessmen too over the 77-78 year. Do you have a list of all the people that you hosted in the residence
yes.
in 1977-78?
Yes. But you're right. And I made a point. I know the staff had the feeling I was overdoing it, but I made a point of receiving as many delegations as possible. Now, I'd have somebody usually from the political section, the economic section, a very general briefing, but inevitably the question of Taiwan would come up, and it was understood that was left to me. During that long period that I was home, I had advanced the viewpoint that we weren't going to be able to negotiate a guarantee of non-use of force, because that meant trying to negotiate sovereignty. That the president should go ahead and do what it was his constitutional right, recognize the government, and be prepared to do whatever we needed to do for the well-being of the people in Taiwan, including selling them arms. And I know in a discussion with Secretary Vance, he said he wasn't sure he agreed with me. Didn't say he disagreed. But certainly if we were to think of that, of doing that, the Chinese would have to know in advance so that they couldn't claim afterwards that we had, in effect, misled them. Didn't take very much thought to realize that that was certainly true. In fact, during this period, when it was talked about, Holbrook used to refer to it as the Woodcock formula. And since it was not policy in all of these groups, when the question was raised, I would answer, well, now, not speaking as the ambassador or the chief of the liaison office, but as an American citizen who worries about this and who believes there should be a relationship between this country and the United States, then I'd express that point of view. I think I changed the mind, for example, of Henry Ford. And, of course, I knew him well enough. This was later, but it was before normalization. He and I had a private conversation, which I said I was absolutely convinced we could do this and the relationship with Taiwan could continue. Well, he left China and went to Taiwan, and he made a public statement to the effect that even if the ties are broken, the Ford Motor Company will stay in Taiwan, because I had said to him I was positive that could continue. Now I had a further point in these briefings. I assumed that what we said in that room was a secret. The Chinese had some way of finding out, but to go beyond that, to make sure, I would communicate to ambassadors who I knew were close to the Chinese this administration wanted to normalize relations, but we had this problem, and it could happen only if we still had the right to sell defensive arms. I know that my memory is that I conveyed this to the Romanian and the Yugoslav ambassador, and also the Pakistani ambassador, that this was, I always try to have it in a natural context where
those were three that you knew had served as channels between the United States and the Chinese,
right,
in the pre Kissinger visit,
right,
era, so that you really did understand you were conveying a message.
And who were also sympathetic to normalization proceeding. And I became more encouraged because I never got any answering echo from the Chinese in any way that this was absolutely unacceptable. Not at any time.
So that you saw as your second responsibility, in a sense, conveying to the Chinese indirectly what you sensed would be our final offer, and creating the environment for it, and also testing to see whether you would get elicit negative reactions, which then would enable you to know that we couldn't move forward.
Yes, I was doing this deliberately because of a big, fat negative had come back in some form.
Right.
This is absolutely impossible,
right,
and I certainly had no right to continue to try and advise my superiors that this was a road down which we could go, yes.
Now, in your developing this, your vision of your role as an ambassador, did you do this on your own, or did you talk through what you were doing to some of your closest aides in the embassy? In other words, was this instinctual on your part, or was it deliberate and crafted in an explicit way?
I think the first time or two it happened, of question is suddenly thrown at me, and I just instinctively answered it in that fashion. At first, the staff was a little apprehensive, but some of them were quite pleased. But it was not anything we sat down and talked about. And they didn't particularly want to talk about it, because if I was out on the end of the limb, I don't think they wanted to be out on the end of that limb with me.
Uh-huh.
Whenever the question, quite often in these meetings, there was a person from the political section, the questioner would direct it. They would always say, that's the ambassador's question.
So it became known as that.
Yes.
Now, I knew very little about this part of your activities. Did you send cables regularly to Harry, let's say, on who you had dinner with? Was there a regular reporting back? Or was that side of things kept fairly loose?
I don't think that was well reported, no.
Because I certainly did not get
that
cables.
That was not well reported.
So that one can say that what an ambassador, I'm trying to understand what an ambassador does in some ways and what latitude an ambassador has. And in that sense, an ambassador is on his own. He can conceive of a role, act upon it, knowing that it fits within policy, but what precisely the role is his to create.
Yeah, the tactical considerations are to some degree under his control, yes.
Sorry to interrupt, but it's interesting.
It was interesting that the same evening that I had the reception and the stiff argument with the committee from the people from the committee for the present danger, I went to my first dinner at the Soviet embassy. I left them to go directly to the Soviet embassy. And it was curious that Ambassador Tolstikov, who'd been in China a long time, who had been mayor of Leningrad and was at one time a powerful person in the Soviet political system, but who had been a Khrushchev protege. So he was effectively, in effect, exiled to Peking. But I happened to walk in a few minutes late, but he comes to the door to greet me, but then he steers me away. They have this building with the huge halls. Yeah, very ostentatiously walks me across the room so that he and I and the interpreter are alone. We were not talking about anything of consequence, but it was made to appear that we were. And then after dinner, when we have had the brandy and coffee, the women all going in one room and the men all going in another, beckons me over to sit beside him, which I interpreted as being, since the Chinese had some question about my strong support of detente, he was just trying to underscore that I haven't changed, and maybe
now
the Chinese
were Chinese possibly present for the dinner.
No.
But he assumed that it would be observed.
There were enough. There were lots of other ambassadors there, and I think he figured that would be talked about. I'm sure it was. And also, at this time, I had a rather. I invited Mr. and Mrs. Frank Coe.
Oh, yes.
To come to the embassy to have a drink. Ken Galbraith had written me letter which I received soon after I got to China in July, and urged me to meet with Frank Coe because I'd get a perspective that might otherwise not be available. Well, somewhat naively, I didn't do anything about it because I knew vaguely about Frank Coe and the relationship with Harry Dexter White and the whole business, and I thought, well, he may be reluctant to accept an invitation from the representative of the American government. So I didn't do anything about it until I came back in November from the United States, and I wrote him a letter, because Ken Galbraith had sent me his address, and asked him if he would care to visit with me in the residence. He called on the telephone the very next day, so as soon as he got the letter, and he and his wife came in, and they looked like they just stepped off Connecticut Avenue. And we had a very interesting conversation. He must have been in China then over about 20 years. Did maybe more.
More.
More, yes.
More.
Did not speak Chinese. Had not had a steady job, but that didn't have a steady job then. Hadn't had a steady job for 10 years. His wife worked for Xinhua and spoke excellent Chinese, but not he. Insisted he had been hounded out of his country, and that China was the only place where he could get a job to pursue his profession of an international monetary expert. And during all of his first period, that's how he was engaged. But then he fell afoul of the Cultural Revolution. He was never jailed or anything like that, but never had steady work. And at this particular time, had been engaged in over a year in the English translation of Mao's the fifth volume. For some reason, I used to think, well, we should have them for dinner or lunch or whatever. And I encouraged the staff to get together with them.
John Jameson told me this summer that you had, and I was going to ask you about this at some point, but now you've raised it, and let's pursue it, that in the course of your time in Beijing, you reestablish contact with a large number of the American expatriate community, of whom Frank Coe was perhaps among the most prominent Americans. But there was George Hatem and the Shapiro, Sidney Shapiro, the Rittenberg.
Right.
And as John described it to me, you systematically tried to establish contact with the whole range of these people.
Well, we did, and we would always invite them. I insisted they be invited to the Christmas party that we had at the residence, 4th of July, and particularly in the later years, they responded. Who was the one who had been, who was in his 80s, maybe 90s?
A Dr. Winters.
Robert Winters. I remember one party we had to finally turn out the lights to get him out of there. He was having a great time. But
now, the previous heads of the liaison office had not established contact with these people, isn't that correct?
No, they had never been invited, that I was informed.
And that, too, was there opposition in the embassy to your doing that? Was there concern? These were people who were thought of as possible turncoats. Did you see it as
I was not aware of it, no. With regard to Frank Coe, for example, Bill Thomas, who was head of our economic section then, was very interested in seeing him, hoping that through his eyes could get a better understanding of how the planning system worked in the Chinese economy. And whether he pursued that or not, I don't know. I encouraged him to. But the only instance where the only instance where I singled him out for an individual reception was the Coase, but that changed with the Rittenbergs later on when we had several exchanges. He and his wife came to lunch, and they used to come with their children to the Christmas reception and so on.
He's now back in the United States, you know.
He's at the new school, yes, in New York. And we've had several telephone exchanges.
He turns out to be a very interesting person. Doug Barnett saw him recently, told me that he found him a really...
Yes, he told me in one of the conversations we had that I think his children were still in China. And he got in some trouble by some of the speeches and articles that he's printed. He had to go back to China to answer. But he said everything was all cleared up and everything's okay. There was some opposition, but it had been taken care of.
Did you have any contact with Korean POWs who remained behind, and there were there?
You mean Americans?
Yeah, the American.
No. I'm sure if that had happened, I would have been aware of it. In point of time, I jumped a bit ahead of myself. Very soon after I got back, Mr. and Mrs. Millard Pryor, who live here in Ann Arbor, had a letter from Bill Haber, a letter of introduction, and I met with them. And she was remembering that she had worked for the Shanghai Post when she was a young girl of 18. First assignment had gone out to come back with a story. She had discovered six dead Chinese in an areaway. And her editor looked at what she'd written and just dropped it in the wastebasket and said, "That's not news, that happens all the time." And she was commenting on this about how different it is now. As I say, they live in Ann Arbor, and in our class, it would be well to get her to come and talk more extensively about her time.
Oh, that's excellent. And also to invite her to our film.
Right.
Good. I can do that.
And then, on a personal note, in this same period when I got back, we had a very difficult problem of a man and wife on the staff who were having extreme difficulties. Who they were is unimportant. But I involved the nurse in the mission, Sharon Tuig, and we had some rather difficult conversations with each, the man separately, the wife separately, which because of the medical psychological problem aspects, Sharon got involved, and I was much impressed with the way she handled herself. And then it was in mid-November, which was just 10 days after I got back, that I had the meeting with the foreign minister, Wang Hua, to give the answer, which is, we've noted before, removed the obstacle that we had dropped in about we had to have an official presence, but did nothing else beyond that. And he was very unresponsive, practically saying this isn't very much of an answer at all. And
I just, the interruption, I want to come back to Sharon at length on a separate interview, but just I do want to raise the question, it is an apocryphal story, therefore, that you met her while getting an inoculation. You met her first on the, through this.
Oh, that was John Fraser, the reporter from the Globe and Mail, because we had a press conference. This, of course, is jumping ahead in time.
Yes.
But towards the end of the press conference, he said, have you ever had any inoculations in Peking, Mr. Woodcock? Oh, I said, yes. Just the other day, I had a tetanus shot. He said, where was that done? I said, over the quarantine center across town. Oh, he said, hasn't Miss Tui ever given you any inoculations? I said, oh, yes. She gave me a gamma globulin shot some 2-3 weeks ago. Oh, he said, that's in the buttocks, isn't it? all I could say was yes. And he wrote a story about playing on Cupid's arrow or something. that had absolutely nothing to do with it. We also in November had the first reception just for Chinese. This is a large educational delegation, 55 in all, who were going to the United States. This was in November of 77. Beyond the what that delegation was, beyond the brief note that this happened, I don't know.
But they were not going as a government delegation.
No, they were going as educators.
Right, because the first government delegation came in early 78 and was the petroleum delegation.
Right, right. And on November 17th, I went out to get a briefing from the French ambassador, Mr. Arnault, to tell me about the French Prime Minister Barr meeting with the trip he just made to Peking. What was noteworthy about that was to say how impressed the Prime Minister was with Hua Guofeng, and that he had used, said Ambassador Arnault, terms majestic, even sovereign, in his manner to describe him. And I remember laughing and saying, well, he certainly must have changed since last August when I saw him. In December, but he postponed it. He had to stay for some Senate votes.
Energy,
right. But I then left on another trip. At that time, it was politic to visit Mao's birthplace because the Mao. Mystique was still extremely strong. So I left on Friday, December the 2nd, along with Don Kaiser, and flew first to Changsha. Visited the normal school where Mao had been, and